I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. You better think, think about what you're trying to do to me. Think that your mind gonna let yourself be free. People are grieving the loss of a music legend this week. Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, died yesterday at her home in Detroit. In the late 1960s, Franklin became a household name after signing with Atlantic Records. Kim Young with the Superior African Heritage Community spoke about Franklin and what her loss means to so many.
It's a sadness because one of our great icons that has been with us so long in the music industry is gone. Trying to be positive, we had her for a very long time, which is a wonderful affirmation of her career and her life, that she was able to make so many people happy with her music and her words and her uplifting.
What was it about her and her music that made her so significant?
She was the Queen of Soul. I mean, she was accepted by Black, white, everyone. You know, her music was some of the first to become mainstream for Black America. I mean, I remember, I don't think there's a household in Black America that did not have her music playing as a child, as an adult. I don't think there's any Black person in America who does not know who Aretha Franklin is. You know, without Aretha Franklin, we wouldn't have had Michael Jackson, who was the King of Pop. We wouldn't have had Prince. We wouldn't have had Lauryn Hill. You know, she's influenced generations of young Black women. She was also a positive role model for bigger Black women. You know, she was not afraid to be on stage. You know, she was not ashamed of being a bigger woman on the stage. You know, there was so much emphasis is placed on being skinny, being fit, being, you know, athletic build when it comes to performances. And she wasn't that. She was a soul singer. She was a blues singer. She was everything that Black women could aspire to be. She was a true idol and an icon.
Do you have a favorite song of hers?
Natural Woman and Respect.
Kind of an anthem for every woman.
Yeah.
Or person, I guess. I mean, she kind of took respect and made it her own.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to add, Kim?
Just that, you know, for many years, you know, it was, Aretha had always been here. I think we kind of look at our leaders and our role models and icons and, you know, expect them to be eternal, you know, with us. And her music will always be with us and to live on that way, but it's always a sad day when one of our icons, one of our community leaders, passes away. I think I'm like everybody else, going to be thinking about her and listening to her music and just remembering who she was and what she meant to our communities.
Franklin died of pancreatic cancer. She was 76 years old. Next, we talk about why women are crowding the field of political candidates this election season. This week, Polk County Attorney Margaret Engebretson beat former Marshfield Clinic CEO Brian Ewert in Tuesday night's Democratic primary for the 7th Congressional District. She will now face incumbent Republican Congressman Sean Duffy in November. Engebretson spoke with me about what she thinks made a difference with voters just after her victory speech in Superior.
Well, there was a few things. I think that a grassroots campaign is the way to win. If you go out and talk to people about what they need and where they want to go and listen to them, that's how you do it. And I think that one of the major policy issues was single payer. People really, really want to transition to single payer. And I think people are wanting different kinds of leaders. And, you know, while Brian and I were both Democrats, we come from very different backgrounds and we have different perspectives. And I think that people are really drawn to something different and relatable and, yeah, they're wanting change.
Well, you mentioned healthcare and rail and broadband as some of your priorities moving forward. What's your next step heading into November?
Representative Duffy, that is our number one goal, is just focusing all of our energies in defeating him. And we're going to go out and solidify the support we already have and try to gain more support and talk about a message about reclaiming our democracy and upholding your oath of office and being present in the district and fighting for investments to bring home, like broadband, rail. These are things that we need so desperately here.
Why is this race so important to you?
Because a lot of people have lost faith in our whole process. I have run across people that said, I don't vote because it doesn't matter. And that's sad. This is a democracy, and people have felt like they've lost control of it. Big money has corrupted our politics severely, and I think that, you know, we just need to get people in office that are 100% loyal to their country and to their constituents and not corrupted by that.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say about your opponent, Brian Ewart?
He was a great person to run with. I mean, we got along well and he gave it his all and we contrasted well. So the candidate forums that we went through, I don't even know how many, but it made both of us better and stronger candidates. And in the end, it will strengthen the Democratic Party of the 7th Congressional District, which is what we need. And we need to broaden it. We need to be an inclusive party and get folks that have been disaffected from the political process. And that's a lot of what my campaign is about, is that, you know, I never even belonged to the Democratic Party until recently, and we need to strengthen it and broaden it.
Elisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. She sat down with me this week to talk about Engebretson's win and what's driving women to run this election season.
I mean, I think there's just a tremendous surge of female candidates at all levels, from local, you know, county school boards, city governments, to the national level. And so the tremendous surge of candidates is in part a reaction to the presidential election and people seeing Hillary Clinton's loss, and also the this whole Me Too hashtag Me Too movement, I think also is part of the part contributor of this, that is engaging women and is making women see their, you know, need to become more involved in the political sphere, whether it is running for office or through another capacity. And so I think that the surge of candidates is, I think, the most that has ever run for office at this point so far in terms of female candidates running in the primary elections. And so it's a tremendous time for women who are in office or who are running for office to take that opportunity to, you know, not, or for those who believe that may not be qualified to run for office, to just take the opportunity to build on this momentum and to jump in and join the fray.
Here in northern Wisconsin this week, Margaret Engebretson, who was one of the Democratic candidates in the 7th Congressional District race, she won the primary. And mm-hmm. she said to her supporters during her victory speech in Superior on Tuesday night that, you know, almost no one expected her to win. I'm not necessarily sure that her mentality had anything to do with gender, or more to right. do with her being a political newcomer. But do you see that at playing a role as far as people's perceptions of whether or not women are successful in their political runs?
I think that, I mean, I think it does play a role, and I agree that I don't think it was necessarily her primary motivation to run as a woman for Congress. But I think that just the momentum that has been building over time, again, since the election in 2016, that you see that there's greater support for, and there has been greater support in the early primaries thus far for women over men. And so whether it's because they're perceived as outsiders, or whether, you know, for some other reason, or just there's an increased level of voters that are turning out in primary elections, who are women there, or those who support women. It's all of those factors, you know, and most likely a lot more combined. But certainly these national tides and national surges, one would assume, play a role in her victory.
And what do you think this says about where we're at in our political history? I mean, coming off of the 2016 presidential election, where Hillary Clinton was the first female candidate for president, you know, I'm just thinking about a lot of places in northern Wisconsin where you typically have seen a male candidate for many, many years. Do you feel like there is a shift happening now where it's becoming more acceptable, or people are more welcoming of women in office?
Well, I can't speak for all of northern Wisconsin, having not visited a lot of it, but I think that there is that transition that is occurring, whether it's generational or also just you know, some other process, that there's greater acceptance, not complete all the time, of course, and there's still the same stereotypes often hold female candidates back when we look at their, you know, campaigning and that sort of thing. But at the same time, there's the number one reason that women often don't run for office is they don't feel themselves qualified, even when they are highly qualified or have the same qualifications as male candidates running for office. And so I think that maybe what we're seeing is a shift in women, you know, letting go of those beliefs and stereotypes that they hold about, you know, their own qualifications, their own ability to be successful and to go out there and run for office. And so I think there's sort of two shifts going on, if that makes sense, that it's about, you know, perhaps among the people, there's greater acceptance of female candidates where we wouldn't have expected it before, but also that it's about a shift in females or women themselves that are more likely to just make the decision to run for office, regardless of the voices in their head, you know, or, you know, sort of the expectations that they're not qualified, don't have the education, the experience, and that sort of thing. So I think both of those things may be at play.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of debate right now in our current political process over qualifications and who has them and who doesn't. But I guess I should also point out, too, in northern Wisconsin, we do have a State Senator Janet Buley, who's a woman, and mm-hmm. also State Representative Beth Myers. So it's not like it doesn't exist here, but it feels like it's something that was less common even just like a decade or two decades mm-hmm. ago.
And thinking about the role that these individuals play in inspiring younger women to, you know, see role models, to see themselves in these candidates, I think is very powerful. And the role model effect can be seen as a very powerful motivator for women to eventually run for office. And so I think, I mean, just the, you know, the presence of those women and other women who are in office, as well as these candidates who are out there on the ground, is very inspiring to younger women to see that it's not just, you know, an all-male, you know, boys club or that sort of thing, but that, you know, someone like them could, you know, decide to run for office and be successful. So it is very powerful just to have all of the females that have run and are in office at this moment, but also those who are running today.
Do you think it's a calculated move right now where maybe some candidates are choosing running mates or looking for women to fill open seats?
That's a definite possibility. I mean, I think that there is so because of what we know just from historical trends, the upcoming general election, the midterm election, there historically the president's party always loses seats. One exception is 2002, shortly after 9/11. And so I mean, just based on those historical trends, we expect that Democrats are going to be more successful or going to be successful, more successful in the upcoming 2018 general elections. And so because of that, again, whether it's Republican or Democrat, using, you know, trying to find female candidates that will hopefully build off of this momentum that's occurring right now. Also the, you know, stereotypes or expectations that women are tend to be more liberal, whether they're Republican or Democrat, as compared to their male counterparts, is something that could be used in that calculation too as well. I mean, but it is a good time to find women if, you know, to run for office. I mean, it is an ideal circumstance in which a lot of the stars are aligning for a lot of different reasons as to why they might be more successful than their male counterparts.
I think that's really interesting. I'm glad you mentioned the part about stereotypes of women being more liberal, because obviously we've seen some candidates who were more conservative. Like if you want to go back in just a few years ago with Sarah Palin as John McCain's running mate. And I just saw a piece this week on CBS This Morning about a woman who was running as a conservative and feeling she was taking a lot of flack because of women's issues like abortion and things like that. Are we seeing more women running on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican?
There's more women who are Democrats in Congress and elected office as compared to Republicans in general. But we do see that there is a, so this isn't all Democratic women, though, that are currently running for office in this election cycle. There are Republican women, and a large proportion of those women are Republican. There's still a majority of women who are Democratic running for office as in this election cycle, but there's still a, you know, very significant proportion of them who are Republican as well. So there's some of that divide is perhaps going to, or that gap perhaps will start to diminish a bit. It's hard to say, you know, what will happen, but there has been that gap between the two parties with respect to just representation of women or women's representation in Congress, certainly.
So do you think this has the potential to have staying power, I guess, as far as the makeup of the state houses or Congress going forward? Or is it more to do with what we've seen in recent events, like with the presidential election in 2016?
Well, with respect to, I mean, the momentum that's going on right now, and I mean, once women are elected into office, their, you know, ability, their power in office as incumbents, and their, I guess, sort of, I want to, lack of a better term, staying power, so to speak, is something that will carry on. And so just simply, you know, the presence of a greater proportion of women in office, you know, regardless of if everything else sort of dissipates and, you know, goes away, you still have a larger proportion of women in office who are there that can make, you know, decisions on, you know, reproductive issues or other issues that are commonly perceived as women's issues. I'd known that I've read a lot of different news stories about women who decide to run for office when they watch the news and see discussions of Planned Parenthood by an all-male, you know, panel of congressmen or any other type of similar issue addressed all by all men. And so I think that their presence will, in and of itself, is, you know, an effect that will be longstanding. In terms of this sort of momentum, more generally speaking, in terms of the opposition to the 2016 elections and the, you know, all of the other sort of momentum part of that is going on right now, it's hard to say how powerful that will be, how long it will sustain itself. But given the ability of the current president to anger his opponents, I don't see that going away anytime soon. And I think that will be something that is motivating in and of itself for a lot of people.
Well, on the flip side of that, I guess, we saw this kind of reluctance among a lot of Republicans to embrace Donald Trump, I think, primarily in 2016. But now, as we come around and are heading into the midterms, we see people who were reluctant now embracing him, like our state lawmaker Leah Vukmir. She's running against the incumbent Democrat Tammy Baldwin for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Senate seat. Do you think that's changing right now, where people, you know, as far as women are concerned, who may have been reluctant to align
themselves with President Trump if they're conservative due to past comments or other issues, that now they're beginning to embrace him because they feel like it will help them in the midterm elections.
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon. And I really haven't wrapped my head fully around the whole that whole idea. And I mean, I think I agree that in that Trump supporters today are, you know, still as strongly vociferously Trump supporters as they were on election day or 2 days before election day. And so that hasn't changed, which is really quite significant in that we see usually over time, even among the key supporters of a president, you know, that support usually goes up, goes down, depending upon different issues. And his has really stayed among his solid base of supporters. Those who voted for him has really stayed quite strong and regardless of what he does. And so aligning themselves with the president for this election cycle may be, you know, useful in the interim or in the short term. What it means for them long term is anyone's guess in terms of, you know, what that does for their, you know, reputation or you know, so to speak, long term. But I think it, you know, for a Republican running for office, obviously depending upon the context, but in general, it would most likely be behoove yourself to align yourself with the president at this point, as the Republicans have, in general, accepted Trump as sort of a representative of the Republican Party.
Right. Yeah, and I think that probably goes both ways. I mean, we've seen that with other sitting presidents, like President Obama, where you would maybe see Democratic candidates distancing themselves with the president based on how well he was doing in the opinion polls at that time.
Or depending upon the issue, the key issue that was, you know, present in their state, if it was, you know, gun control or another, you know, contentious, you know, social wedge issue, that if the president had gone out and recently made a statement or was, you know, there was a law about to be passed or some sort of thing, that it was more common for those individuals that have a moderate or perhaps a more of a swing district to distance themselves, to run ads, you know, in opposition to the to a sitting president and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think it changes depending upon the waves of what's happening at the current moment and what the issue is and what the larger national context is. So I don't think that it will necessarily be damaging and for most women running for office. And again, I think that if anything, it would be more helpful for them in terms of their getting that base Republican support for them and turning out for the election in November.
Okay. So despite which party they belong to, both sides are using President Trump as kind of like a flashpoint to motivate voters to get out to the polls
yes,
in November.
Yes, very, very much so. Very much so. Absolutely. And I think it's anyone's guess to see which party is going to be more successful at doing so. But in terms of the special elections that have occurred since the president has taken office, Democratic candidates have won a majority of those special election seats up to date. And so it doesn't necessarily mean anything for the November general elections, but I mean, it is an indicator that it is encouraging more Democrats to get out and to vote, at least in those special elections that have been occurring, that occur every now and again as people resign or leave office. And so, again, whether that momentum will continue on is anyone's guess, but
and have welcomed political newcomers like the 29-year-old bartender in New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She defeated 10-term Congressman Joe Crowley.
Yes. That was huge. You know, I guess on both sides of the aisle, whether you're Democratic or Republican, there's still this sense of, you know, wanting to bring outsiders in or, you know, to change the way Washington runs, is operating. And so that's sort of a feeling on both sides of the aisle. So you
right.
have these candidates that can unseat, you know, 10-term congressmen, which is very rare occasion. And so I think, you know, that sort of sentiment, that feeling is also something that's beneficial for female candidates and that they're generally seen more often as sort of these outsider candidates, whether they are or not, and, you know, how much that plays a role in their success or In the generals is anyone's guess, but it certainly is a time where that characteristic would be valuable.
So what do you make of Margaret Engebretson's win in the 7th Congressional District? She's going to advance to face incumbent Sean Duffy, the Republican, in November.
So first, I do have to admit that I don't really follow local politics very much. But and you know what? It's funny because so the first thing that I thought of when I saw your email was, and this is just obviously just for Superior, but like I didn't know who Brian Ewert yeah. was, like that her prominence in terms of yard signs anyway, like I, you know, how much that's an indicator of like success is anyone's guess. But I guess it was interesting to me to think about then how much more, again, perhaps more of a base or more of a presence she has in Superior and how that, you know, what that effect that had on the election. But I think in terms of their issue positions, they really weren't terribly different. I mean, they were fairly similar on most. I mean, there are two Democratic candidates wanting to unseat Duffy, and so there wasn't any major, that I can recall anyway, any major differences between the two on, you know, these major social issues or prominent national issues. And so really it's a contest between two personalities or two, you know, people's stories, so to speak, with respect to making the decision to run for office. And in terms of her background and just her, I mean, experience in every field known to man, so to speak,
right.
I mean, it's
yeah.
her background is, I think, so varied, allows her perhaps or maybe allowed her to more easily reach out to certain communities or to have connections in certain communities, certain networks. In these fields that she's worked in.
Having the background as a lawyer, as a veteran, you know, with her service in the military, having been a former corrections officer. Mm-hmm. I know I'm missing something.
There's like an electrician journeyman.
Yeah, and being a part of worked for the railroad and being having a union background.
Which I think that, I mean, again, the presence in those fields and working in those different industries and attending UW-Superior for her Bachelor of Arts degree, that, I mean, she becomes embedded in those communities and perhaps has more grassroots support, as she was outspent by Ewert in the primary election by a considerable amount. And also, too, just her, again, not to say that it's about just simply her gender, but, you know, that whole momentum and that, again, I always look to, you know, hashtag Me Too, you know, like, I mean, that it's been very powerful in a lot of different ways with respect to politics, whether it's the actual, you know, dealing and addressing with, you know, sexual harassment and sexual assault, but also serving as a force of mobilization more generally. And so, while she didn't run on that, you know, sort of position as a woman running for Congress, but I would think that she would surely have benefited from some of that larger momentum that's occurring nationwide because of that.
Well, and also, as you mentioned, her position as an outsider. I mean, her challenger, Brian Ewert, had the endorsement of former Congressman Dave Obie and longtime state senator Bob Jauch, mm-hmm. and also Mary Heft, who ran in the 7th Congressional District. So I think, you know, she seemed to buck the establishment in that way.
Right. No, certainly. And I think that's something that mobilizes individuals or that people find a viable characteristic in candidates running for office. But I also think, too, that there was, at least with respect to absentee balloting, is all we have information on thus far, but in Wisconsin, the number of absentee ballots requested and returned was just under the number that was just the number of absentee ballots in the 2016 presidential election. And so one would presume that the turnout for this primary election was higher than the last primary cycle. And so when we have that higher turnout, it's most likely people who haven't turned out before, you know, which is younger voters, perhaps people who aren't part of that establishment or known, you know, about that network or community or that sort of thing. So I think her background and experience perhaps spoke more to people, you know, on that level that aren't part of the, you know, or at least aren't supportive of that establishment that was so powerful in this area in years past.
Well, I know I've taken up a lot of your time, but is there anything I'm missing that you want to add about what we're seeing right now in politics, especially as it relates to women?
Wow. Do you have time? No. You know, one thing that I found that was very interesting. So Vukmir, running for the Republican in the Senate primary, she was outspent considerably by her opponent.
Kevin Nicholson.
Yes, who lost. And Margaret Ingebrigtsen also was outspent considerably by her opponent as well. And so I just find that, it's only two individuals. I can't speak to the power of, you know, those just want two cases, but I do find that interesting that, you know, these two individuals were able to be profoundly successful when people presumed that they wouldn't be, that they were perhaps bucking the establishment or that sort of thing. And so I just found that to be significant and interesting, and wondering more generally if, again, that's tied to this larger trend or this mobilization of grassroots efforts, you know, that they perhaps have created, or of women, people who are more interested in these outsider candidates. I don't know what it means yet, but I found that fascinating.
Well, I mean, we're certainly seeing some new faces rather than well-known names.
Yes, and I think that's kind of part of that's the demand, again, on both sides of the aisle, is that, you know, that there's needs to be new faces, new people, new blood. And I actually just heard an interview with the woman in Minnesota who received the victory in the Democratic primary for the House seat. I'm not recalling her name, but she was being asked about voting for Nancy Pelosi, whether or not she would vote for her Nancy Pelosi as majority leader if, you know, that were to be the case or that had to happen. And she kind of, you know, sort of danced around it a few times, but eventually said, you know, there needs to be new blood. There needs to be new faces, new people, new perspectives in this, particularly in that position. And so I think that there's that feeling, or that it's part of the ethos that is occurring right now, again, on both sides of the aisle. And so candidates that fit into that sort of ethos or that outsider feel are certainly going to be, at least have an easier time, I guess, so to speak, but are going to be more in tune with voters, you know, needs and interests at the moment.
I wonder how that will speak to relations in Congress as they're working on bills and trying to compromise on issues. If you have a lot of established politicians who have been there for years and years and years, you know, what it's going to be like if you have all these political newcomers coming in.
Right. And I mean, we have had eras of this before. I mean, in 1992 is the year of the women, where there was the unprecedented growth of women in Congress. It was shortly after the Anita Hill hearings. But there was a lot of this mobilization, this stirring of women to run for office. And there was sort of overnight, just boom, this larger presence of women in office. And the next election cycle, 1994, the year of, that's been called sort of the year of the white male. There are examples of these moments of tremendous turnover, or, I mean, if not tremendous turnover, at least, you know, a fairly significant proportion of newcomers. And it does make things a little more difficult at first in terms of, you know, the learning the ropes and just understanding the sort of informal rules of the game, so to speak, and whether or not a group of new faces in this next election cycle, you know, I guess it depends upon their size and the strength of their group to sort of combat some of the powers that be that are currently in office. Again, it's obviously hard to guess at this point, but it perhaps is part of that necessary process of eventual, you know, turnover and of generational change and bringing in newcomers. And if anything, while it may be rocky at first, one would hope is only beneficial in the long term.
Again, you were just listening to Elisa von Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at UWS. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. Something muddied the waters recently on pristine Lake Superior's shoreline. Blue-green algae was spotted along a roughly 50-mile stretch from east of Superior to the Apostle Islands. The bloom appears to be the largest one witnessed on the lake so far. Julie Van Stappen with the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore says researchers are now trying to find out what's causing them to form.
So I actually got a call from, you know, we have staff at Myers Beach, and so I got a call from them about, oh, I think it was about 4 o'clock on a Thursday, and they reported a, you know, an algae bloom out at Myers, and so I got in touch with, tried to get in touch with Brenda and a bunch of other folks, eventually was able to get in touch with Brenda, and our staff collected algae samples, but Brenda, she was, I think, on her day off and ran over to Myers Beach, and she was able to get some samples as well. So she was really quick. And then she got in touch with the researchers out of University of Minnesota Duluth that are doing work on near shore environment and tributaries, and then also helping us out with a number of other things. I think they came out the next day, and they were able to get samples as well.
And how big a concern is this for the park then?
Well, it's something that we hadn't seen until 2012, and that's when, you know, we had that big flood from Duluth, and then a couple months later, all of a sudden, you know, there was algae, and it was pretty shocking to us because we hadn't had algae blooms that we know of before. But then, you know, we had a little bit of an algae bloom in 2016, and then 2018, you know, which kind of follows those flood years. So it's happening more and more. So we've had, 500-year floods in less than 10 years. We've had three of them. So the problem with the algae bloom is obviously, you know, water quality, and then they can have toxins, and that's a concern both for people and pets especially. So right away we told people, you know, don't submerge within the water, don't let your pets drink in there, and then also apparently boiling and filtering really doesn't take out toxins if they're there. So, you know, you need to watch out because a lot of people obviously filter water from the lake. So if you see green in the water, you don't want to filter.
Robert Sterner is the director of the Large Lakes Observatory with the University of Minnesota in Duluth. He says the blooms do appear to be linked to heavy rains and flooding the region has seen in recent years.
It's also true that the blue-green blooms that appear in the lake occur many, many weeks after the storms. And it's not immediately clear what that connection is. Somehow it has to do with, we guess, nutrients or sediment coming in the water, and then it taking a very long time either for chemical processes to occur or for biological growth to occur until we finally see a bloom. Another probable triggering factor is water temperature. Generally, we're seeing these blooms occur in the warmest of the years, and we also believe there's some local meteorological effects having to do with wind. So there's a number of different factors here that we're basically trying to untangle.
But you don't have any definitive findings yet from past sampling or anything like that?
No, but these blooms are a worldwide phenomenon. And so we already know that to have a bloom, it takes relatively high nutrient concentrations. One of the things that makes us interesting scientifically is how a generally low nutrient lake like Lake Superior can still create these harmful algal blooms. Or I shouldn't say harmful algal blooms because we don't know that yet. It is an algal bloom. We don't know yet the level of toxicity. Those measurements are still being made. But the type of algae that we're seeing here in Lake Superior are of the same type that can become toxic. They aren't guaranteed to be toxic. They're not always toxic, but the forms that we're observing are ones which can become toxic.
Stirner says they should know by the end of this week whether the bloom was toxic. If it was, he's not expecting levels that would raise concern for animal or human health. Researchers will continue to test samples for concentrations of phosphorus and nitrogen in the coming weeks. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out, and here's a look back on the news of the week. Polk County Attorney Margaret Engebretson beat Democratic challenger Brian Ewert in Tuesday night's primary race for the 7th Congressional District. Engebretson advances to face incumbent Republican Congressman Sean Duffy in November. During her victory speech, Engebretson told a crowd of supporters in Superior that almost no one thought she had a chance to win Tuesday's primary. She says the votes show you don't need money to win.
And you don't need to be part of the system to run a winning congressional campaign.
Former Congressman Dave Obey endorsed her Democratic opponent, Brian Ewert. The former Marshfield Clinic CEO says he will back Engebretson in her run against Sean Duffy.
There comes a time where you just have to finally defer to the will of the voters and say they had two good options put before them, and they went to the polls and made their decision.
In a tweet, Duffy thanked his supporters and said he will, quote, continue to fight for policies that help people reach their American dream. Women with military experience, many of them combat veterans, are among the record number of female candidates running for office this year. Some aspire to change Congress, where veterans account for just 1 in 5 lawmakers. Most of the candidates are Democrats, and many are mothers. Some have retired and are looking for other ways to serve. The female veterans have expertise in national security and veterans issues, with a track record of thriving in institutions dominated by men. Regardless of party, they cast themselves as the antidote to bitterly partisan politics, describing themselves as, quote, mission-driven and trained by the military to work toward a common goal. Today, just 4 of the 535 members of Congress are female military vets. Around 1 million people in Wisconsin voted in Tuesday's primary election. That's about 22% of registered voters in the state and the highest turnout since 2002. Olivia Shalaby reports some counties in northern Wisconsin saw a high turnout, while others saw fewer people head to the polls.
Douglas County Clerk Susan Sandvik says this year they saw a 25% voter turnout. Sandvik says that compares to 30% in 2016.
You know what I think was happening or going on that election versus this election? We had a local race. I believe we had a sheriff's race where it was contested. And this election, we had the two local offices, the sheriff and clerk of court, were unopposed.
Wanda Heinrichs is the Burnett County clerk. She says around 3,500 voters showed up at the polls. Heinrichs says that's 38% of the registered voters in Burnett County. She says that's much higher than 2016, when only 13% of people voted. Heinrichs says local races drove turnout this year.
It was the sheriff's race. Definitely the sheriff's race. We had a huge, huge campaign for this race, you know, very hardworking candidates.
In Bayfield County, voter turnout was between 33% and 37%. County clerk Scott Fibrett thinks more people showed up to the polls this year. He says turnout usually hovers around 25% to 30%.
There was nothing at the county level, but the governor race is a big issue, and we are predominantly a Democratic county, so I know that had a lot to do with it.
Fibrett says the race for lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and state treasurer also drew more people to the polls. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A majority of Ashland County residents voted down a referendum asking them to pay more to fund services in Tuesday's primary. Roughly 64% of county residents opposed a request to increase the tax levy in unofficial election results. The county asked voters if they would support raising the property tax levy by roughly $1 million to pay for services. Ashland County has contended with rising costs to its Health and Human Services Department, as well as the Ashland County Sheriff's Office. County officials say increasing costs are related to drug abuse, particularly meth. The number of felonies related to drug abuse in Ashland County has more than doubled in recent years, from 122 in 2011 to 303 last year. The cost to the county for placing children in out-of-home care rose from roughly $405,000 in 2016
to $721,000 last year. Six counties in northern Wisconsin have received a federal disaster declaration after flooding in June caused roughly $13 million in damage. Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler says the federal declaration means more money for towns to repair damaged roads.
They'll be able to recover 75% of their expenses to repair the damage to the public infrastructure like the roads and highways from the federal government. And then the state will kick in 12.5%. So at the end of the day, the local municipality only has to pay 12.5% to repair the roads.
Kessler says damage estimates decreased in Douglas County from roughly $5 million to nearly $4 million. He says federal officials whittled down claims because it was difficult to determine the cost to repair dams that were damaged there. Jan Victorson is the Emergency Management Director for Bayfield County. She says local governments have been hoping for federal funds to assist with the recovery.
This is huge. Our towns are low population areas. It figured out to be, if we were to have every person in our county contribute in order to make the repairs, it was estimated it would be over $250 per person. So in terms of the tax levy, that would have been huge for our small towns.
She says the county sustained nearly $4 million in damage to roads and public infrastructure. Many towns are looking to borrow money to fund repairs before they receive reimbursement. A recently released study says Great Lakes ports in Wisconsin have a $1.4 billion economic impact and support more than 7,400 jobs in the state. The findings were presented at the annual meeting of the Wisconsin Commercial Ports Association in Superior. The study looked at 15 Wisconsin ports. It was conducted by economic consulting firm Martin Associates and paid for by marine industry stakeholders. The study says the state's largest Great Lakes ports moved around 27 million tons of cargo last year. Wisconsin Commercial Ports Association President Dean Haynes says future growth for ports may be in shipping containers.
We're always going to have the raw materials moving and some finished goods, but the future will be in intermodal. Intermodal meaning a combination of moving things in containerized units from truck, train to ship.
Port directors say they're keeping tabs on the Trump administration's tariffs and how that may impact cargoes moving in and out of the ports. Superior and Milwaukee port directors say they're optimistic about growth this year. The study found the aging Soo Locks account for about 17% of that impact on the state. Superior Planning and Ports Director Jason Cirk says another large lock is needed at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, to keep business running smoothly.
If that Soo Lock goes down, the large portion that supports the 1,000-foot vessels, we're talking about potentially loss of 1,000 jobs and over $230 million of investment or cargo movement.
Cirk says the Port of Superior moved around 22 million of the 27 million tons shipped through Wisconsin's largest Great Lakes ports last year. Researchers are trying to pinpoint the cause of a recent blue-green algae bloom on Lake Superior. The bloom appears to be the largest one witnessed so far on the lake. The bloom has been spotted along a roughly 50-mile stretch from east of Superior to the Apostle Islands. That's according to Rob Sterner. He's the director of the Large Lakes Observatory with the University of Minnesota in Duluth.
Generally, we're seeing these blooms occur in the warmest of the years. And we also believe there's some local meteorological effects having to do with wind. So there's a number of different factors here that we're basically trying to entangle.
Sterner says high levels of nutrients can also lead to these blooms. Researchers are testing samples for concentrations of phosphorus and nitrogen. He says they're also testing whether the bloom was toxic, but he doesn't expect to see levels that are harmful for human health. A jury has found two people guilty of disorderly conduct and obstructing an officer following a Line 3 protest in Superior last summer. They were arrested for trespassing on the site where Enbridge Energy was replacing its aging oil pipeline in Wisconsin. 24-year-old Alexander Goodcane Milk secured himself to an excavator, and 26-year-old Kyla Hassig streamed video live on social media. Both refused deputies' request to leave the site. Attorney John Bachman says he and attorney Ralph Hurwitz tried to show their clients felt they had no other alternative.
That given the reasons and the urgency and the exigency of stopping climate change and particularly the pipeline, was in effect an act of civil disobedience, would allow them to defend others.
Douglas County District Attorney Mark Fruhoff says their motives could be considered noble.
They're doing this because they think they're protecting the environment and they're saving the planet, basically. I guess my response to that is maybe this will lead to change with the law. I don't know. But the act of committing a crime in furtherance of your cause, it's still a crime, whether you're a good person or a bad person or your motives are pure or not.
Hasseg was sentenced to pay fines and serve 20 days in jail. Good Cane Milk will be back in court for sentencing in 2 weeks. Northern Wisconsin tourism officials have been appointed by Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker to the Wisconsin Council on Tourism. Michelle Martin and Mary McFetridge will join the board, which works to develop the state's tourism industry. The 21-member council has 14 citizen members who are appointed by the governor to serve 3-year terms. Michelle Martin is currently the executive director of the Washburn County Tourism Association. She's served in the position since 2009, and Mary McFetridge is the executive director of the Ashland Area Chamber of Commerce. She's been director there since 1999. And a woman will lead the Duluth Seaway Port Authority for the first time in its more than 60-year history. The Port Authority's board unanimously appointed Deb DeLuca as executive director this week. She has served as the Port Authority's government and environmental affairs director since 2014. And that's a look back on some of the news of the week, and that's it for our program. On Monday, WPR will air a live debate between 25th Senate District candidates at 10 a.m. Incumbent Democrat Janet Buley and Republican challenger James Bolin are vying for the 25th Senate seat. Again, that's Monday at 10 a.m. on WPR stations. And next Friday, we'll bring you an interview between WPR reporter Glenn Moberg and Republican Congressman Sean Duffy. That's next Friday morning at 10 and Friday evening at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio stations. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.